Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with Hope White, data consultant, and Sherry Lehman, HIV consultant for North Carolina Healthy Schools, about healthy youth and risky behavior.
Yeah, they're research ongoing of the Youth Risk Behavior Survey in North Carolina and many other states around the country. A similar survey is really interesting about all kinds of issues, from weight to tobacco to sex and HIV to violence, everything and anything.
I know. I'm looking forward to that conversation. But first, Adam, we have some research that matters about living longer and hepatitis C.
About which jobs may be worse for your heart than others.
And about eating organic food. And I'm looking forward to that because I think I have to. Is it called Eat Crow? Or what is it called when you have to, like...
I think just a little... We're all a little more humble in the face of our own mortality.
Exactly.
How about that?
Okay.
But let's start out first about, speaking of humble, should we just get rid of our kids and send them off to college? Because they'll not just make them smarter, it'll make us actually live longer. What do you think, Christy?
Well, this is fascinating. Okay. So they did some research on over 25,000 individuals tracked in this health and retirement study.
By the RAND Corporation, very prestigious think tank.
Mm-hmm. And they found that there is this effect of a child's education, and going to college in particular, on the life expectancy of the parents. And it was not just related to how much money the parents had and all of the factors that go into your child going to college. But even after controlling for that, if you sent your kid to college versus having them drop out in high school, you were likely to live a couple years longer.
Yeah, they say this was like about two-thirds of the benefit of running every day. And even getting your own college degree only gave 1.7 years to your life compared to not having the degree. So it was like, let's just send our kids to college and everything works out well. I don't think it works out that way. I was a little like, my first comment was, duh.
I know. But then, you know, some of the discussion and hypotheses about this are that, you know, college-educated adults, if our kids go to college, then they're better equipped to take care of us when we get old. They might be able to navigate the healthcare system more easily or be able to have more resources themselves, more money themselves to help us.
Or help us change our unhealthy behaviors.
That is a good point, Adam.
My college-educated children are so interested in my own health. I don't know, Christy. I'm a little bit dubious, but I think, how is this? No one can argue against this. This is like a good thing.
Right. Of course you want your children to go to college if possible and to get as much education. But this just gives another little thing of, huh.
We're doing this for all the right reasons.
It helps your child
us.
And also for yourself.
That $200,000 college education, it's worth it for us, if not for them.
Okay.
Let's talk about our very next research that matters, about an important health issue that may be extinct or certainly rare in the next 30 years.
Okay, hepatitis C. So this is actually a viral infection that gets into the liver. And you catch it through infected blood transfusions, tattoos, other elements that exchange bodily fluid. And you can have it, not even know it. And it can cause your liver to have scarring. It can increase your chance of liver cancer.
Yeah, and this particular research that was in the Annals of Internal Medicine was actually a computer simulation saying, well, with the new drugs that we have available to treat hepatitis C, with the recommendations that everyone between the ages of 1945 and 1965 who was born those years get tested, and with perhaps the decreased transmission through our blood counts, instead of having 1 out of 100 Americans have hepatitis C, we could cut this down to 1 out of 1,500 in the next 2 decades. That would be huge.
It would be remarkable. So this is a combination of people getting screened more often and the treatments getting better and less transmission. And that's just a shout out to anyone who's born between 1945 and 1965. You should have a one-time blood test for screening. Like when you go into your physical, you should mention to your doctor, hey, I don't think I've ever been screened for hepatitis C.
Yeah, there are one of the medications that's new on the market called Sovaldi, which is much less side effects than the medicines that were out there, interferon. The problem is that particular medicine cost $1,000 a day or $84,000 for a 12-week course. OMG. We're going to have to do a lot more work on bringing down the cost of the drug, getting more competition to that marketplace, and making it more available. Because right now, that's a huge problem.
That is a problem. Okay, well, let's talk about jobs being hard on your heart, which is also a problem.
So this was research that was came out in MMWR, or the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, compiled by the Centers for Disease Control, looking at the kind of impact of having a job and what types of jobs in heart disease.
So workplace factors that can increase your risk of heart disease are just overall job stress. You don't experience that at all, do you, Adam?
Absolutely not. Being a doctor, none.
No, okay. Job stress, exposure to air pollution at your job. That could be dust, secondhand smoke, and noise. So really loud noises or shocking or surprising noises, all of those things can increase your risk for heart disease.
Even being unemployed. Now, that's a really interesting one because unemployment actually could be associated with a lot of other bad health conditions that may be the reason why people are unemployed.
And it would also be stressful.
And incredibly stressful. So this is all feeds into, and we had one of our guests on our show, which was the director of employee wellness at University of North Carolina, about these programs for disease prevention, health promotion, and wellness in the workplace. Very important.
Yeah, and I think it also helps reframe for us all that these healthy choices and behaviors that we make, it's not just what we do when we're on our free time, but also trying to look for ways within our work environment that we can influence our health. And sometimes that requires some organization or advocacy for, you know, your factory or your place of work. But if you can get people to buy in, then they also are going to, if you're healthier, you'll be able to work better and work longer.
Speaking of healthier and choices, let's talk about our last research that matters. And Christy kind of said earlier she may have to rethink something, and we'll see. This is some research that was in the British Journal of Nutrition, a meta-analysis of lots and lots of existing studies looking at the impact of organic foods as it relates to two things, pesticides and antioxidants. Pesticides being bad for you to be exposed to in your urine and foods, and antioxidants, the more than your diet, the better.
Okay, so over the years, we have acknowledged that Adam eats organic food and I do not. And as I read this, it actually has leaned me into the grocery store a little bit more towards the organic food, because what they found in all of these review of studies is that the organic foods had higher levels of the antioxidants, the reason, you know, all the healthy parts of eating your fruits and vegetables, and lower levels of pesticides compared with the produce that comes that's not organic.
And in this meta-analysis combining of these 343 previously published studies, the organic foods had also more what's called flavonoids, those types of antioxidants that may have the special protective properties.
The good
stuff.
And it
was significantly higher of that particular element. So I think where this doesn't make the link is with the specific diseases. But if, you know, riding a bike is exercise and riding a bike causes you to lose weight, well, then we know that that losing weight would lower your risk of obesity. So I think we're getting much more of the picture here of where these organic foods, the real key is making them available at a cost,
yes,
and affordable for really the population. That's the next key.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that pushes us in to really think about how you grow your food has an impact. So hopefully we can make headways in those areas.
That'll conclude the research that matters. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Hope White, data consultant, and Sherry Lehman, HIV consultant for North Carolina Healthy Schools, about healthy use, risky behavior. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to have a really interesting conversation with Hope White, data consultant, and Sherry Lehman, HIV consultant for the North Carolina Healthy Schools, about healthy youth risky behavior.
Welcome, Hope and Sherry. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
I wonder if we might start by way of introductions. If you would tell us, we'll start with you, Hope, about what has led you to this role, line of work, and what you do.
Okay. I am the data policy consultant for DPI.
That's the Department of Public Instruction.
Yes, thank you, Adam.
Okay.
And I recently moved to the area from Virginia Beach. There I worked for the school district for 7 years, working with a variety of different type of educational data. And this position allows me to continue to work with data, work with students within the educational field. But it also lets me get out of the office and go to the schools and talk with students and staff and that sort of thing. So
fantastic.
I enjoy that.
And we're going to be talking about this major report that comes out every year, this YRBS, the Youth Risk Behavioral Survey. And we're going to, in surveillance, we're going to talk about that. But maybe first, if we could hear, Sherry, a little bit about your story and what do you do?
I am the HIV Policy and Programs Consultant at the Department of Public Instruction, and I've been there on and off for about 8 or 9 years, but I got started, or I became passionate about working with youth health issues. I started out actually as an exercise physiologist working on obesity prevention, and what I found was that even though we gave nutrition information and we gave information about exercise, that people were oftentimes not able to meet their goals. And I believe that it was because we weren't addressing the mental health component of it. Hmm. And so I went back to school and got my master's degree in mental health. And while I was doing that, I actually worked at the National AIDS Hotline. And so that led me to DPI, working with HIV and sexuality education. And I've been there pretty much ever since.
Great, wonderful.
Fantastic. Now, you were both involved in this survey, and, you know, it's shortened YRBS, and Adam, you try to sort of explain this Youth Risk Behavior Survey. Help our listeners understand what that is and why collecting that information is important. Maybe we can start with you, Hope.
Okay. It is a survey that is conducted by the CDC every 2 years. It's administrated locally. At the state level. And the survey covers a litany of different types of health risk behavior questions for youth, everything from smoking and drinking to sexual activity, diet and physical behavior. The survey is conducted in order to assess trends in health behavior over a period of time. Are we doing better in helping students resist the temptation to have sex? Are we doing better in helping students not try smoking? So these types of trends we look at over a period of time to see if the interventions are working.
And so you're going into the schools and administering this to the kids. Do the parents have to consent?
There is parental consent that's required for each student to participate.
And how many students in North Carolina? We're talking about middle school and high school, hundreds of thousands of students. You must have to sample a lot of different schools and a lot of different students.
Last time in 2013, we had 40 middle schools and 40 high schools, and we had over 1,800 high school students and over 1,400 middle school students to participate in the random sample schools.
And you're having to convince each and all these schools and school systems and school districts to participate, because I assume they're not getting paid a lot of money to participate.
Actually, they don't get paid any money to participate. And so, yes, we do spend a lot of time explaining to the principals and administrators the benefits of the survey and getting them to dedicate class time to allowing the students to take the survey.
And then what happens with the information? You produce an amazing and very detailed report, but then how does that influence people's decisions about public health or about money, or what happens with the information?
The survey is actually used quite a bit in public health, and oftentimes it's used in writing grants to get money from the federal government to provide some kind of intervention or prevention for a specific topic area.
So you could say, hey, things are getting worse in the area of helmet wearing or something, and we're having all of these problems with concussions and trauma because kids aren't wearing their helmets, and then perhaps try to start something to intervene in that area.
Absolutely.
And I know we're going to want to kind of dive right in. It's just like a feel like you're going to have your hand in your cookie jar because there's so much wealth of great data here. But I know you also do analysis by looking at the age of the respondent and the types of answers they give about their ethnicity to better understand and gender. Tell us a little bit about how those sorts of data is important to the work you do.
Well, there are certain types of questions that are asked that tend to have a larger percentage of females having those issues, being bullied, having weight-related issues. So you try to focus your interventions around females who are having those issues. Males tend to have issues related to violence, so you initiate certain types of initiatives related to those things.
So within those disparities, which one comes to mind as the one that was either surprising or shocking to you, that just is disturbing? There were several that came to my mind, but you've seen this data more than me.
I guess there was nothing that was terribly shocking to me. As I think about texting, because that was a question that we added this time around, texting while driving. I want to say it was almost even between males and females, and when I generally think of texting, I think of teenage girls.
Girls.
Text while they drive, but I think the results were saying that it was almost neck and neck.
You know, and Christy and I were looking, and sometimes data doesn't tell the whole story. I think we were looking at some research a few weeks ago where we saw that texting, that maybe some of these females texting actually be responding to parents, that parents are texting and calling, not you know, and always worried about where their kids are. But I tell you one thing that, and this is just to me as a public health researcher who's actually worked on like campaigns to try to get kids to wear bicycle helmets, I was looking at your data over 20 years and I saw that the number who students who say they ride a bicycle and who never or rarely wear a bicycle helmet has actually changed very little over 20 years, and that, you know, and as they get older, even less wear it. And it appeared to me that there was some disparity that the black youth wore a helmet less than their white counterparts. And so I wondered, you know, does this mean that we're not making enough progress? Does it mean, you know, is there public policy approaches? I don't know what the answer is, but I was really struck by the fact that here's one example where it doesn't appear that we've done as much as perhaps we could do. I don't know. As a parent or as someone who is in the school system, do you think that these conversations are part of the school system or are they part of the public health venue?
I think that they're actually a part of both avenues, that we definitely have those kinds of conversations in schools because we have health education or healthful living, as we call it in North Carolina. And a lot of the different risk behaviors that are addressed in the survey are things that we talk about in the classroom. And so it's addressed through the schools, but then also, again, I think the research and the dollars and the answers oftentimes come from the public health arena.
We were talking about driving earlier and texting while driving. I was really pleased to see that we have made a significant decline in the number of middle schoolers and high schoolers who reported riding in a car with someone who was drinking alcohol. So, I mean, and that was pretty significant. 39.6 in 1995 down to 19% in 2013 for middle schoolers riding with someone who's drinking. Do you think that's about law changes in North Carolina? Or, I mean, as a parent, I look at that and just think, wow, we've done something well, but I don't, how do you guess what has impacted that?
I would say that it's probably a combination of different things. National media campaigns at the high school level, they have the situation where they have the graphic simulators, what happens after a DUI and a crash, and those are very rememberable. So I think it's a combination of a variety of different things.
It's a success story.
Yes, sure, absolutely.
Well, we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with our guests, Hope White, data consultant, and Sherry Lehman, HIV consultant for North Carolina Healthy Schools, about healthy use, risky behavior, and here's some success stories and maybe some challenges. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Hope White, data consultant, and Sherry Lehman, HIV consultant for North Carolina Healthy Schools, about healthy youth risky behavior. And before the break, we were talking about this survey that goes into the middle schools and high schools and guides us in our public health efforts and ways to try to make our children safer. One of the things we talked about as a success story was this number, the decline in the number of high schoolers and middle schoolers who report riding in the car with someone who's drinking. And I immediately assume, well, that means that when they're going to a party or they're riding to something that they're not, you know, throwing beer cans out the window like you see in the movies. But maybe there's more to it than that if a middle schooler is riding with a parent who's drinking. How do you tease out what really is what they're thinking as they're filling out these questions?
I think that's part of our partners at Public Health. That's a lot of what they do to try and figure out exactly what this data means. Because like you said, it can be interpreted a lot of different ways based on your personal perspective mm-hmm. and your personal experience with that specific risk behavior.
Sure.
And when we do actually administer the survey, if students ask questions about the actual question they're trying to answer, the only thing we can tell them is to do the best they can, because we do not want to influence what their interpretation of the question is.
Can you write down their questions so that then if you people are repeatedly asking, do you mean, are you talking about when I ride with my father who drinks alcohol, that you could write those things down to guide future question writers?
Oftentimes, it's not the question itself, it's the interpretation. For example, okay. since I'm the HIV consultant, I'm uh-huh. most familiar with sexuality education, and one of the questions we ask is, have you ever had sexual intercourse? Well, based on things that you've seen in the news,
sure.
that can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people.
Uh-huh.
And we don't want to tell kids specifically what that is. They get to decide what sexual intercourse is for themselves.
Well, can we jump to that? Because that is shocking. At some yeah. point, I want to talk about sexuality.
We can go into sexuality, but I also want to talk about a little bit about violence, because again,
okay, this is violence. We'll come back to
we'll
sex.
We'll come back to sex.
We're coming back to sex, everyone.
It's hard to come back to anything after sex. So let's talk about violence first, like that. But I think there's this belief that there's this epidemic of violence in schools. In the YRBS, which is actually every state, or almost every state probably does this survey, so it's relevant around the country. When I saw that data that said, had they ever been in a physical fight, half had said they had, and had they ever carried a weapon such as gun, knife, or club to school, about a third said they had. And those things hadn't changed over time much, but then those who had been threatened or injured by a weapon in the school had actually gone down by two-thirds. So I thought, huh, are schools less safe? What are your just thoughts as an educator, as someone who's in the school systems, and what you know and hearing from this data? What do you think?
I think schools are trying to assist students and helping them use their words more instead of using violence more. There are certain types of programs that are in the school, like mentoring programs. I think these types of initiatives help reduce violence and that sort of thing. So I think that's part of what we're seeing.
And then even, I guess that back in 2005, almost 10% of students said they felt unsafe at school or on their way to school, and that's been cut in half. So clearly what you describe the schools have done here, they maybe get an A-plus job. Maybe we're not giving enough credit because schools are being called upon. You know, we're talking about health, and they're really focused math, reading, education, computer literacy, and here they have to deal with health and violence?
Absolutely, and that's, as you have said multiple times, Hope and I both work for Healthy Schools at the Department of Public Instruction. And we know that students learn better when they're healthy. And so that's our job, is trying to get kids to be healthy and recognize the importance of health in academics.
Okay, we got to move into sexual health.
Okay, let's do that.
Now, I know, Sherry, you have experience with this in your counseling and your area of expertise. So we were looking at the sexual activity of high school students. And, I mean, at first it was surprising. 32% of the high school students had had sexual intercourse with one or more people in the last 3 months, which sounded high, but actually it was lower than what we've had over the last decade. And then in middle school, and these kids are 11 to 14, somewhere in that range. So 11.4% of the middle schoolers reported having had sexual intercourse at 11, 12, 13 years old.
You'd mentioned before that it, you know, you have people have different perspectives on how they look at the data. One of the things that that does not tell us is whether that was consensual sex. And the reality is an 11-year-old can't consent to sex. But mm-hmm. we don't know whether they were forced to have sex or whether mm-hmm. it was something that they theoretically chose to engage in.
So it's not just promiscuous young people or young people getting promiscuous even earlier, but maybe a change in abuse and other factors.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we don't know the answers to that, unfortunately.
And so where do you go with that information? It sounds like there's been some success with the high schoolers with some drop in sexual activity over time. But how do you address this shocking information about these children?
Well, I think the exciting news is that in North Carolina, we do start teaching about sexuality education in seventh grade. We do puberty education in fourth and fifth grade, and then start talking about sexually transmitted diseases and how to protect yourself in seventh, eighth, and then high school. And so I think that what this confirms, because this is the first time that we'd asked that question on the survey in uh-huh. the history of the survey in North Carolina, and what that confirms is the fact that we do need to be teaching these skills and this information at that young of an age.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we think about teaching the skills, there was an interesting question on your survey about the percent of students who said they had been taught in school about HIV or AIDS. And while two-thirds said that they had, that number to me appeared to actually be kind of slowly declining based upon 10 or 15 years. Does that mean we're being more complacent about it? Or help us understand, you know, if we were all sitting around here and we were all educators and health and doctors sitting around, what do you think we would do with that? I don't know what the answer is. What do you think? Do you think we have to redouble our efforts, or do you think that maybe that doesn't mean they don't know about it? This just means they're knowing about it outside of school.
Adam, when you talked about complacency, I think that may play a big role in this issue, and the fact that if you were alive and in school in the 80s, and you know when people were dying, and if you got HIV, you got AIDS, and then you died. That's not happening as much anymore. Not that people don't get HIV, but they live longer. It appears to be a chronic disease instead of a disease that kills you. And I think because of that, the urgency is no longer there. So we do need to bring that back. And we do need to be really focusing on the prevention of HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases.
So as you look ahead at the survey and its use and how it applies in North Carolina and other states, it's extended to middle school and high school. But there are a lot of health behaviors that children may adopt even sooner, particularly around eating, obesity, physical activity. Do you think this will extend into elementary school? Do you think it would be helpful if it did? Does that overwhelm you because of how hard it is to get the population you have? What are your reactions?
You want another contract, Hope?
Well, you need a raise is what you need.
For some of the questions at the elementary level, there would be a concern from parents about asking certain things, but I could see your point when it came to asking questions about weight and that sort of thing, because those behaviors start early.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows? I haven't heard of the CDC say anything about administering the survey at the elementary, but who knows, because we're at the middle and the high right now.
Do you worry about those types of questions, or do you feel like the data's too critically important and the teachers, you equip them with some skills on what to do with these types of answers? Because I can imagine this is scary. What do you think?
I think it's interesting the way you're wording that question, because when we go in, we ask the teachers to leave the room, and then who's ever there monitoring as it's being administered is asked to stay in the front of the classroom. And when the students bring their results up, they slide it into an envelope. So the teacher, whoever is in the room, never actually sees the results. So confidentiality is a very, very important piece of collecting this data. Additionally, we never report the schools or the students that are actually answering the questions. And so there's no way to track it back to mm-hmm. Betty Jo or, you know, a specific student at a specific school.
And that's this balance that the administrators had to decide of trying to get accurate information. They're more likely to tell you if they really trust that it's not going to be linked back to them.
Correct.
But yet then you can't intervene to that individual.
Yes.
we can't tell you how much we appreciate you taking the time with us, Hope White, data consultant, Sherry Lehman, HIV consultant for the North Carolina Healthy Schools. It's been one of the great successes in North Carolina and perhaps around the country. And we know that your work is important. And on behalf of your health listeners, we want to thank you for the time and effort you give to our youth.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first health call question today about depression.
I'm in my 30s, and I'm in generally good health. I've had trouble with depression over the last several months, and I feel like my depression is out of control. I have trouble keeping weight on, I have no appetite, and my hair is falling out. How do I know if this is depression or another medical problem?
Oh, that is an excellent question. It's sometimes really hard to determine, is it the depression making your appetite be low that then makes you lose weight, or is there something else going on like thyroid disease, or maybe if there's substance abuse involved, if there's substances that are making you have those feelings. It can be difficult to tease out the chicken or the egg.
In this particular case, I think, though, that you're on target. Mm-hmm. You've really kind of started out by saying, I've had trouble with depression, and you feel like it's out of control. And then you're talking about some of your physical problems. Mm-hmm. Many of the people in my experience who talk about their physical problems, and then kind of later on you get to the depression, then you kind of have some kind of doubts here. But I think you're on the target. I think you're absolutely right, Christy. It could be some of these other issues. But if we took 100 people, 99 of them, like you, might have depression. And it is a medical diagnosis. It's a medical condition, and it can cause these things. So I would really try to treat that depression, really get it under control, and then see what happens. You're pretty young. The likelihood of something else going on is less.
That's true. That's a really good point. Well, we wish you the best as you're seeking and getting treatment for that depression and figuring out what's going on.
Erica, what's our very next house call?
I became injured while playing soccer. I went to the doctor, and she said I had a high ankle sprain. I was so exhausted by the time I was seen that I simply didn't ask any questions. What's the difference between a high ankle sprain and a regular ankle sprain?
Well, the ankle sprains are one of these things that everyone kind of knows what they are, but it is confusing because they're intuitive or easy to kind of sometimes diagnose, but they're sometimes much more difficult to treat. So this is a really good question.
And a lot of people say, oh, it's just a sprain, you know, I didn't break it. But sprains can get really swollen and be very, very painful. So there are these different classes of sprains, lateral, meaning like the outside of your ankle, medial, like the inside of your ankle, and high, meaning a little higher than your ankle.
Are those medical terms, Christy?
I'm trying to break it down.
The outside, the middle, and the high portion. But no, these high ankle sprains are kind of the more unusual ones. They're only about, you know, maybe 10% or so or less of all ankle sprains. And it kind of happens, you know, not just when the ankle twists outside or twists inside, but when you're kind of running and your foot gets kind of pounded up and out and your leg's rotating and it puts a lot of strain and the pain is not just an ankle, but it's kind of going up the leg a lot.
It hurts me to picture it, Adam.
And it's painful, really painful. You see this a lot of times in athletes or basketball players. And those type of ankle sprains can be really unstable. They actually, from the outset, might require an orthopedic referral versus the vast majority of all other ankle sprains can be very easily managed. Physical therapy, family doctor, medications, rest, ice, compression, elevation, a lot of things we can do.
Well, and those high ankle sprains are more likely to be recurrent, and so you want to make sure you do your rehab and really focus on getting that as stable as possible before you return to soccer. Good luck to you. Let's take our next house call question.
I do not have diabetes, but I was told I'm pre-diabetic. I received a prescription for diabetic shoes, and when I went to get them, I was told I might not need them at this point. What's the deal? Do I need them or don't I?
Pre-diabetes, most times we don't recommend diabetic shoes for pre-diabetes. We recommend diabetic shoes to people who have diabetes and therefore are at risk of having problems healing, wounds, ulcers, problems having normal sensation in your feet. I would say if you have pre-diabetes, you really want to focus on losing weight. If you're overweight, really focus on losing weight and worry less about your shoes and more about trying what you can to get the weight off, assuming you're overweight.
Yeah, I'm not. Well, I think this is like, you know, do I need it? Do I not? Does she love me? Does she not? There's an element here of serendipitous, perhaps, that yes, if you lose the weight, you won't need it. But on the other hand, there may be some problems with your feet too. So things can coexist. So your feet could have these bunions on them. Your feet could have calluses and corns. And whether you need a diabetic shoe, maybe not, but maybe you need good foot care regardless. And that's what a lot of us don't think about enough is we don't give our feet very good care. Do we put lotions on our feet frequently? Do we cut our nails appropriately? Do we get foot massages? When's the last time you get a foot massage,
Christy? Oh, that's what we all need.
Okay, our prescription are foot massages and lotion. And losing weight.
Lose weight, yeah. That's a really good question, and we appreciate you taking the time to write it. Erica, what's our last house call question of the day?
My neighbor said her mother is prescribed and smokes medicinal marijuana every night in order to sleep. I've been taking trazodone at night for years to help for my depression and in order to sleep. However, I looked into side effects of trazodone, which include nausea, dizziness, insomnia, and blurred vision, and think marijuana may be a better choice if it's approved for medicinal use in North Carolina. What do you think?
Well, we got about
a loaded question.
We got a lot of things to say here. First off, I'll say that I think North Carolina will be one of the last states in the union that will approve this. That doesn't mean it won't happen, and it doesn't mean that I don't think then limited use and medical prescriptions, but I don't think it's going to happen soon, but other states are allowing that.
And so with that in mind, we would not recommend you using an illegal substance because aside from our thoughts about it, you could get in trouble with the law by taking that. So we're not going to recommend that. However,
we should also say that you're being treated for depression in addition to insomnia, and you're taking trazodone, which isn't necessarily the first, second, or third drug that I would use for depression, and you may not be taking it in the doses that are used for depression. So if your insomnia is related to your depression, there may be better medications for you, and that's something you could talk with your physician about, because if you read about any medication, almost all of them prescribed and even the unprescribed, they're going to talk about some of these same types of side effects.
So I don't know if you've tried something called an SSRI, that class of medication for depression, but a lot of times people who have depression and take those medications then experience less insomnia because the depression is under control. And there are other things that I'm sure you've done but might be worth revisiting, like exercise, sleep hygiene, even melatonin, which is more of sort of into your body rhythm rather than something centrally acting like marijuana.
And Christy and I have done some shows about and talked about the whole host of behavioral therapies, which would be our first, second, and third line approaches to really insomnia. In addition to sleep hygiene, relaxation therapy, sleep restriction therapy, cognitive therapy, other approaches, and these are the things that we're really, really think important. We do wish you luck. We know this is a difficult question, and we appreciate you giving us a chance to kind of grapple with it. It's not an easy answer.
Yeah, we could only touch on it, but thank you. And thanks to all of you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope you've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to your health, and we want you to share your questions, share your stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Follow us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and get our health app from the App Store.
We'd like to thank the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, University of North Carolina Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guests today, Hope White and Sherry Lehman. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.